It is Monday, July the 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, some U.S. lawmakers upset the U.N. will vote on Iran deal before they do.
They have a right to have a vote, but we prevailed on them to delay the implementation of that vote out of respect for our Congress.
Also ahead, big trip this week to Africa for President Obama, plus it's a new day for Cuba and the U.S. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The Obama administration is continuing a media blitz to promote its landmark nuclear deal with Iran to an American public distrustful of Tehran. The lengthy, complicated, and highly technical pact unveiled in Vienna last week is proving to be a tough sell to nearly all Republican legislators and even some members of Mr. Obama's Democratic Party, who have 60 days to review and vote on the accord. VOA's Michael Bowman begins our coverage of the Iran nuclear deal.
Did Iran win too many concessions while giving up too little? Appearing on U.S. television, ABC's This Week program, Secretary of State John Kerry said no.
The United Nations resolution, which brought about the sanctions in the first place, said that if Iran will suspend its enrichment and come to negotiations, all the sanctions will be lifted. Now, they've done more than just come to negotiations. They've actually negotiated a deal.
Key lawmakers remain unconvinced and angry the United Nations could approve the deal before Congress has a chance to weigh in. The chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Republican Bob Corker, had this to say after meeting with Vice President Joe Biden.
The president is going to go to the UN Security Council Tuesday before Congress has done its work. I mean, at just a base level, that's highly problematic. I'm very concerned that with all that's happened, what that's going to mean is that they're going to be agreeing to an agreement that they don't even know they can implement.
Not so, according to Kerry.
They have a right to have a vote, but we prevailed on them to delay the implementation of that vote out of respect for our Congress.
Even some Democrats most loyal to President Barack Obama, like Senator Ben Cardin, are not committing to a yes vote.
We have 2 months, and we're going to use that time to better understand this. And I respect the fact that this is not an easy decision for members to make, and I plan to take the time to understand it before I make my decision.
The president will need the backing of Cardin and others to prevent Congress from overriding his veto of a likely congressional vote disapproving the deal.
This deal will make America and the world safer and more secure. Still, you're going to hear a lot of overheated and often dishonest arguments about it in the weeks ahead.
Meanwhile, Iran's supreme leader and top cleric pledged to continue his country's assertive role across the Middle East, adding that should war come, the United States would suffer humiliation. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
There was a time when Iran and the U.S. cooperated in a number of areas, including education. Last month, the Institute for International Education led a group of academics from U.S. colleges to Iran. They were there to explore potential areas of renewed cooperation. VOA's Ira Melman spoke with the group's Deputy Vice President for International Partnerships, Daniel Obst, who explains the nature of the cooperation between Iran and the U.S. before relations soured back in the late 1970s.
Well, in past years, there has been some cooperation between academic institutions, but generally limited to individual faculty members discussing, but also to some student exchanges. There are about 10,000 Iranian students in the United States. But what was lacking, really, are the institutional frameworks that match research and exchange priorities on both sides. So really, this effort of this delegation was to explore how to collaborate more on research, more on program development, and on student and faculty exchanges.
Well, one would imagine there's still suspicion in both countries, as there is around the world, about any kind of cooperative effort between the U.S. and Iran. Is that posing any problem or problems?
Well, what we found on the delegation was that there is enormous goodwill in Iran towards the United States, and especially in the education space. Because I think what we found is that many of the academics and professors that we met on our trip were actually educated in the U.S., or their children are currently studying in the U.S., so there is a lot of familiarity with the higher education system in the U.S. and a lot of goodwill.
Now, until this agreement is agreed upon, and I'm talking about the one reached in Vienna over the past week or so, can you go forward? Has anything been done? Has any progress been made?
Well, we just came back from our delegation a few weeks ago. We plan to release a white paper later this month, and that white paper will actually lay out some recommendations for what types of educational activities to pursue, but also help U.S. educators and Iranian educators understand what is allowable under the different restrictions. So I think there was a lot of confusion around what you can or can't do, and there's a lot that can already happen.
So what would be the scenario you can envision if everything you see for the future comes true?
Well, what we've seen is that a lot of institutions on both sides were particularly interested in expanding cooperation on the research side. So, and especially looking at research areas of mutual interest, for example, nanotechnology, medical and health sciences, but especially water conservation and environmental management. And it was really interesting to see that almost every institution we went to expressed interest in exploring research cooperation around water shortage because it's such a huge issue in Iran. But in the U.S., we face similar challenges because of the long-term water shortages affecting the Colorado River Basin. So you see there are a lot of different similarities in terms of the research interests, and I think a lot can happen when we cooperate.
Daniel Obst is the Deputy Vice President for International Partnerships at the Institute for International Education in New York City. Daniel, once again, thanks for being with us. Always appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And many thanks to you, gentlemen. For more on the VOA coverage of the Iran nuclear deal, check out our website at voanews.com. Now we turn to what's happening on social media, particularly Twitter, regarding the deal with Iran. International Edition's G. Abby Lee is right here to tell us about all the buzz. Hey, G.
Hi, Steve. For today's segment, let's take a look at the different views between Washington and Tehran on the nuclear deal this weekend. The White House tweeted Sunday, "Without this deal, there would be no limits on Iran's nuclear deal. Hashtag Iran deal." That's a quote from the U.S. President Barack Obama on the agreement. That tweet has been retweeted about 130 times and marked as a favorite more than 150 times. The White House is on Twitter, at White House, and the president is at POTUS. That's P-O-T-U-S. President Obama himself didn't tweet at all this Sunday.
I see, G. So was that the main tweet out of the White House Sunday?
Well, it's one of the 7 tweets with hashtag Iran deal from the White House Sunday. So I'd say Iran in general is a main topic coming out of the White House.
What about the Iranian side?
Steve, as you know, the supreme leader is the most powerful figure in that country, not the elected president or the cabinet. So let's take a look at what he tweeted. Khamenei tweeted this Saturday that even with hashtag Iran deal, our policies toward U.S. quote-unquote arrogant system will see no change. U.S. policies in the region, he means the Middle East, differ through 180 degrees from Iran's. That tweet was retweeted almost 170 times and marked as a favorite more than 100 times. Khamenei is on Twitter at Khamenei underscore IR, that's K-H-A-M-E-N-E-I underscore IR.
So both accounts used hashtag Iran
deal.
That's right. How popular was that?
Quite popular, actually, given that it's been a trending topic for weeks now. The social media analytics website Topsy shows that that hashtag was used more than 16,000 times in the last 24 hours. Back to you, Steve.
Yeah, many, many interesting thoughts there. Thanks, G. That's G. Abby Lee, our social media guru. By the way, if you'd like to follow G on Twitter, her handle is at G. Abby Lee. You can also follow VOA's International Edition on Twitter, our handle at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat.
The African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct.
And adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America. Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
This is VOA's International Edition. Also in the news, German Chancellor Angela Merkel has again rejected proposals to write off part of Greece's debt, but says her government will show the flexibility in new talks about how Athens structures its bailout repayments. In Athens, embattled Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras faces some new parliamentary challenges this coming week as his administration seeks approval of the new wave of reforms that have been demanded by its European creditors in exchange for more loans, some of which have been already okayed by the European finance ministers. President Obama traveling to Africa this week, where he'll make stops in Kenya for the Global Entrepreneurship Summit, as well as becoming the first sitting U.S. president to visit Ethiopia. And as for that GES summit, VOA's Carol Castiel speaks with Monde Muyangwa. She's director of the Africa program at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington. Ms. Muyangwa talks about the significance of the summit and President Obama's participation.
This is very important, both to the U.S., but also to U.S. global relations, particularly with emerging economies. The Global Entrepreneurship Summit was actually born out of President Obama's 2009 speech in Cairo, in which he highlighted the importance of economic development to helping emerging economies fulfill the potential and the potential of their peoples. So it's absolutely critical. He has participated in one form or another in all prior GES summits. But I do think this is uniquely important because it is the first time that it will take place in sub-Saharan Africa. It is also important because of the role that Kenya plays in terms of being a hub of innovation, particularly in the IT sphere, but it is also the largest economy in East Africa. So it is important that Kenya is hosting this summit. The president's ties to Africa also make this an important trip for him and for the continent, and especially his ties to Kenya itself.
I have no doubt that he will be received with great affection.
Absolutely.
What do you think are the expectations from this summit?
The Obama administration has really tried to focus the spotlight on the economic aspects of its engagement with the rest of the world. And when it comes to Africa, you see this, I think, most vividly with last year's U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit, which was the first ever summit with African leaders that the United States has held. So it was a historic summit. Its focus was on business and economic engagement with Africa, because I believe President Obama really believes that you can assist Africa and emerging countries by helping them develop their capacities in that economic sphere. So it was a resetting or almost a repositioning of U.S.-Africa relations, and this helps him to consolidate his legacy in that area in terms of U.S.-Africa relations.
Well, speaking of which, and we know, Monde, that you were instrumental in helping organize that summit last year, what about concrete results in terms of economic development? And of course, we know Power Africa. Talk about ways that we can measure the U.S. impact thus far because of this policy.
Concretely, I think the Department of Commerce, for instance, has undertaken a lot of work over these past years with trying to encourage U.S. businesses to engage in Africa with trying to create an environment that allows more U.S. businesses, both medium size and large scale, to do more business with Africa. We've also had the renewal of the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, which for many years has served as the cornerstone of U.S. engagement with Africa. It was just renewed for another 10 years. So I think this speaks to the commitment of this administration in terms of pushing forward with enhancing trade and investment with Africa, and I think it's a win-win situation for both Africa and for the United States.
Monde Muyangwa is the director of the Africa Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Thank you so much for your time and thoughtful insights. It's been a pleasure.
Likewise, and thank you so much for having me.
And you can hear more of that conversation by going to our website at voanews.com and search under the Programs tab for Press Conference USA. United States and Cuba set to reach a milestone in diplomatic relations today. The two countries will formally reopen their embassies. That is a move that's part of a series of recent steps to reset the relationship that began to sour more than 50 years ago. In May, as an outward sign of how relations had thawed, President Obama and Cuban President Raul Castro greeted each other with handshakes at the Summit of the Americas in Panama. And earlier this month, President Obama said the move to reestablish ties was long overdue.
When the United States shuttered our embassy in 1961, I don't think anyone expected that it would be more than half a century before it reopened.
Even though relations between Havana and Washington are improving, U.S. officials are vowing to continue to raise questions about Cuba's human rights record as well as other areas of concern. And as these relations normalize between Washington and Havana, VOA's Kane Farabaugh reports, for those looking to improve the business and trade ties, the ultimate goal is ending the U.S. economic embargo on Cuba.
Though the corn and soybean fields of Illinois seem a long way from Cuba, farmer Wendell Shawman welcomes the normalization of diplomatic relations. His ultimate hope is lifting the economic embargo, and soon.
Well, sure good for agriculture. It's our market for the taking. It's close. The transportation cost is low. We've got the products they need.
Products Shaman says Cuba is also looking for from other suppliers who can extend it credit for purchases, which is why time is of the essence.
We have increasing competition from especially South America, but even Ukraine and sometimes India. There's a lot of competition out there. A market that's close to you, you sure want to grab.
Much of Shaman's corn and soybeans reaches the Mississippi River, where his products are transferred to barges that eventually make their way to the port of New Orleans, Louisiana.
Once the embargo is lifted, we're estimating an uptick of anywhere from 10 to 15% of our entire volume, our entire business, if you will. That's a substantial amount since we're one of the top 5 or 6 ports in the United States.
It's not just the exports from the U.S. that would increase, but imports from Cuba as well.
Prior to the embargo, Cuba's largest trading partner was the port of New Orleans. At that time, it was a lot of sugar, a lot of coffee, a lot of products that were grown in, certainly in Cuba. And we look forward to a return to that.
Roger Noriega, a top State Department official in the Bush administration, is among those who oppose ending the embargo on Cuba, as long as it remains a communist country.
Having to do business with the regime that's turning around, using what profits it derives from this trade to suppress people. I don't think that's something that people want to do in good conscience.
But for Wendell Shawman, Cold War animosities are a thing of the past.
For us, we're looking at it as a market. There's some sympathy for the people that got ran out of there 50 years ago, but that happens around the world. There's not a lot we're going to do about it in the middle of Illinois.
Lifting the embargo, agriculture experts project U.S. exports to Cuba could triple by 2020. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Monmouth, Illinois.
And still ahead, 50 Cent in bankruptcy. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Professional astronomers, with help from amateur stargazers, have discovered a fascinating binary star system some 730 light years away from us in the Draco constellation. This two-star system contains a very hot and dense white dwarf that is actually devouring its larger companion star by stealing its gas. The scientists say that the white dwarf's mass is so dense that a teaspoon of material from it would weigh as much as an elephant. Another factor that sets the star system apart from others is that it contains a large amount of helium, but no hydrogen, which is very strange since hydrogen is the most common element in the universe. The University of Cambridge-led team made their findings by analyzing data gathered in 2014 by the European Space Agency's Gaia satellite, along with additional observations made by a collective of amateur and professional astronomers. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Very good to have you with us today. You know, soccer or football, one of the more popular sports played by children, and at the same time, research is underway right now to study how head injuries, such as concussions, suffered by young people playing the game, and on those long-term effects of those injuries. We get more now from VOA's Mike Richmond.
Soccer is known as a physical game, but not a violent one. Still, players take blows to the head through headers, as well as collisions with other players, the ground, and goalposts. Catherine McGill, a neuropsychologist for the Children's National Health System in Washington, examines many children who have suffered concussions playing soccer. She says concussions caused by soccer and other youth sports are on the rise.
One, we're getting better, and I say we, meaning parents, coaches, and medical providers alike, are getting better at recognizing and responding to that injury. And that's a huge testament to media paying more attention to this and leagues paying more attention to the safety of their players. Also, kids are getting bigger, faster, stronger across the sports, and so more injuries may be occurring simply because of that, and more kids are playing sports and they're playing more frequently, right?
McGill participated this week in a panel discussion in Washington on efforts to make American-style football safer at the youth level. She later spoke to VOA about soccer. She says researchers are looking into a number of questions about soccer-related head injuries, including the impact from repeated headers and whether blows to the head can lead to chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, a degenerative brain disease.
We're often asked by parents, what's the age? What age should they start heading, or should there be heading at all? And the answer is, this is a very individual decision. The age for one child may be very different for an age at another child, right?
McGill advised against putting children on the field who are not physically and emotionally ready to perform headers, or else there will be injuries such as concussions. Mike Richmond, VOA News, Washington.
But many of them score by doing those headers. Difficult thing. Let's shift our attention now to the world of music, where rapper 50 Cent has declared bankruptcy after a court ruled that he had to pay $5 million to a New York woman for releasing a sex tape without her permission. David Byrd and Ray McDonald now talk about the multimillionaire's case, which will go ahead despite his insolvency.
When your album is Get Rich or Die Trying, and you actually do get rich and don't die, to declare bankruptcy might seem a little strange. Ray, what is this with 50 Cent saying he's bankrupt or filing for Chapter 11 protection?
It was all a strategic maneuver, Dave. On July 13th, 50 Cent filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy just a few days after losing a lawsuit. He was ordered to pay a $5 million compensatory judgment after a woman sued him over a sex tape he posted featuring her a few years back.
Now, this woman is rapper Rick Ross's ex-girlfriend.
That's exactly right, and 50 is beefing with Rick Ross. So.
And so this is kind of like, okay, I'm going to shame you in public. And
jab you.
Okay, but the court ruled in the woman's favor that she was actually defamed or libeled, or not libeled, I guess that's print, but she was defamed by this videotape.
This is correct. Now, back in May, Forbes magazine estimated 50 Cent's net worth to be $155 million. I think it's important to note that the man is not out of money. In fact, he's making light of this entire situation. He posted an online photo of himself standing next to a tiny little smart car, saying, yeah, things are tough out here.
My money on my mind, got a meal out the deal, and I'm still in the grind. That shorty says she filling my stash, she filling my flow. A girl from Woody, they buy, and they ready to go. I'm getting rough, bottle full of blood. Mama, I got what you need, you need to fill it up.
Well, now, he wears Armani suits and Jimmy Choo shoes. He has, like, a Rolex on his arm.
He's doing promotion for his latest movie, Southpaw.
Right, and he also sold his vitamin water interest for $100 million. Now, he did have to pay out another judgment when somebody sued his headphone manufacturing company for copyright infringement or trademark infringement or something?
This is correct. And 50 makes the point that when you are successful, he says, I have a bullseye on my back. I'm an easy target. But this lawsuit has not played itself out yet. The $5 million judgment, as I said, is for compensatory damages. Punitive damages are still to be determined.
So he could be forced to pay this. I thought when you go into Chapter 11, that protects you from your creditors, so all these judgments against you and anybody you owe money to just disappear.
In a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, proof of insolvency is not required to file. It's more a reorganization of whatever assets you do have. How much does 50 have? At this point, we don't know, but we may find out.
All right. Now, if you want to send Ray a tweet, he is RayOnTheHits at Twitter.com. You can also hit him up on at VOA underscore music. And, of course, you can send us a tweet here at International Edition. We are at VOA underscore IE. And if you want to hit me up, I'm at David underscore DBird. And that's BYRD on Twitter.
You know, your speakers have to be pretty good ones with 50 Cent's music. I tell you, all that bass, huh? Very good. Here we go. Another item for you. Patrons at a bar in the U.S. state of New Jersey this weekend had a night to remember when singer-songwriter Bruce Springsteen gave a surprise show that lasted nearly 2 hours. He performed 15 songs, a mix of favorites that spanned his whole career. He's long been known for those drop-in performances at various hotspots, but the 65-year-old rocker hasn't done that in a long time, making Saturday night's event even more special for the fans. Springsteen's appearance came during a show by Joe Grushecki and the House Rockers. That's a band he's appeared with numerous times over the years. Well, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. It's always good to have you with us. We hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up next. For our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Xiaogong Chang, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
4 years ago this month, South Sudan celebrated its independence with much jubilation and great hope that a split from the North would finally put an end to decades of civil war. That, unfortunately, was not to be. The relative peace that followed lasted all of 18 months. In December 2013, a political schism evolved into widespread conflict that, in part, devolved along ethnic lines. The conflict is remarkable in its brutality against civilians. This has been stated in a number of reports from NGOs and the United Nations that take note of human rights violations and abuses committed by both sides. They range from ethnically motivated murders to gang rapes and the mass destruction and looting of civilian property. Thousands have been killed, 2.4 million have been displaced, and almost 4.6 million are in need of humanitarian aid. On June 27th, the United States urged the United Nations Security Council to blacklist 6 rival commanders from South Sudan for threatening that country's peace and stability. On the government side, they are Major General Mario Changwang Yaw Mangwak, Lieutenant General Gabriel Jok Riak, and Major General Santino Deng Wal. Rebel leaders to be sanctioned are Major Generals Simon Gatwich Dual, James Koang Chual, and Peter Gadet. In a July 1st vote, the Security Council agreed. All 6 had previously been sanctioned by our Treasury Department regarding their financial transactions. South Sudan's political leadership has squandered the international goodwill that accompanied its independence and pursued political and economic self-interest that has produced only violence, displacement, and suffering for the South Sudanese people, said U.S. Permanent Representative to the United Nations Samantha Power. Political and military leaders on all sides of this conflict must put aside their self-serving ambitions, end the fighting, and engage in negotiations to establish a transitional government.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.